Good morning, Chicago. Woo! All right. So you're thinking Luke Appling versus the White Sox. What does that mean? Some of you are thinking Luke Appling versus the White Sox. What on earth does that mean? Some of you are thinking, well, maybe not in this crowd. Some of you might have been thinking, who's Luke Appling? Some of you might be thinking, who are the White Sox? All questions and more will be answered. So we come back to September 27th, 1967, a story that many of you are probably familiar with. The American League is knotted up in a four-way pennant race between the Minnesota Twins, the Detroit Tigers, and a couple of pair of Sox. How do we get here? You also notice that way down at the bottom, 29 games out, Kansas City Athletics, how do they figure in this story? Well, funny story. So how'd the White Sox get here? Well, they've clinched their 17th straight winning season, which is a franchise record, probably their best period of success other than the dead ball era. They had one World Series appearance during this time in 1959. They had five second place finishes and seven 90-win seasons. One of those seasons, 1964, they missed a trip to the World Series and a chance to get mauled by Bob Gibson in 1964, when they won 98 games, their fourth best record ever, one game out of the series. I was born in 1964, so you can bet I was following this situation not at all. I think I was trying to pull myself up and as a prelude to walking. So now we are in 1967, the 17th straight season. Six of the same 12 players over there are on the top 12, but the team has changed quite a bit. From you see that Ron Hansen went from an MVP candidate. He still got some MVP votes, but doesn't have the power he had. Went from 20 home runs to 8. Tommy Agee, who was the rookie of the year in 1966, was the second best player. So not a lot of power or hitting with this team. The pitching carried the day with the White Sox in 1967. They somehow managed to hold first place from June 11th through August 12th or so by as much as 5.5 games at one point, but were never quite able to pull away from the pack, and the others kept pace. White Sox hitting, as we mentioned, was not very good during this period, but yeah, they were 10th in the league in OPS, but you have to consider they were playing in Comiskey Park, not a good hitter's park. They were playing in 1967, which is the second dead ball era. So when you make all of those adjustments for park and era and league, they vault all the way up from 10th best hitting team in the American League to 9th. They really weren't that good of a hitting team. Even if you look at their home and away splits for 1967, the away splits are just a little bit below average, league average. They just were not a good hitting team. They got things done with pitching and defense. Joe Horlin, who was distant second to Jim Lonborg, Horlin had 19 wins. Lonborg had 22 wins. You might think, well, they were going by wins. Nah, Lonborg was pitching in Fenway. He was pitching under tougher circumstances. I think he deserved the Cy Young that year. But Horlin did get a couple of votes to finish a distant second. Gary Peters, who was the 1963 Rookie of the Year, so the White Sox have two Rookies of the Year playing on this team, was a 20-game winner and had done pretty well. So the White Sox are getting there based on the arms rather than on the bats. So Chicago Tribune readers wake up to find that Chicago and Minnesota are locked in first place with Boston and Detroit a game or two games out. A couple of days after that, why am I picking August 22nd? Funny story. But Eddie Stanky is going to make the remark in a few days here that these other teams ought to be embarrassed. He will be quoted by in newspapers all over the country as talking about Boston. Why does anybody think they're a good team? And Detroit, they've got all this talent. They should be way ahead of the pack. And Minnesota, they've got Killebrew and Oliva, but who else do they have? And Basically, those other teams should be embarrassed that we're in first place. Well, they wouldn't have to be embarrassed for very long. But the other teams, you know, you think, okay, Bolton Board Father, this will get them fired up. They'll be thinking, well, Stanky will show you. But they really don't. Nobody really pulls away from the pack here. And as you'll see, we'll do a week-by-week breakdown of the pennant race here in a moment. It's not going to get, nobody's really going to emerge as a front runner out of these four. So we mentioned Luke Appling versus the White Sox. How did Luke get into this situation? Well, Luke played for the White Sox from 1930 through 1950 with a little time off for World War II. So he missed the 17 straight winning seasons streak completely. In fact, during Luke's tenure with the White Sox, they only had six seasons of 500 or better baseball. The closest they came, they forget about being a World Series team, the closest they got to first place was 1940 when they were eight games out of first place. They were fourth place, and they had two third place finishes, but they were much further away from first place than eight games. Their best record, forget about winning 90 games, granted it was a shorter season, but their best total for a season during Luke's tenure with the team was 86. Luke is still arguably the best position player that the White Sox ever had. Frank Thomas was by far and away the greatest hitter the White Sox ever had. He played first base and designated hitter. Appling was a shortstop for almost his entire career. Appling is still the White Sox career leader for WAR, games played, hits, all of it. He probably would have gotten 3,000 hits had it not been for World War II. And among shortstops, you can argue he's the sixth highest for career WAR. He was the leader for games played at shortstop until Louis Aparicio passed him. He's now eighth on the list. Is he the greatest baseball player who ever lived? No, of course not. But he's definitely, you know, in the conversation for greatest White Sox player, and in the conversation for is he the greatest shortstop? No, Hannes Wagner was, but you know he was definitely a great player. After his career, though, he had the aspiration to manage, so the White Sox sent him to their Memphis affiliate, where he won Minor League Manager of the Year and took the pennant. In 1952. He also had first place finishes with Memphis in 53 and Indianapolis in 62. But many people have said, and I think people would agree on this, that Appling really wasn't cut out to be a manager. He was in many respects not a disciplinarian, not, you know, he was a very well-liked and well-respected player. He was more comfortable, and his daughter mentioned this too, when my partner in crime, Richard Smiley, and I interviewed her last month, but he was definitely more comfortable as a coach. He enjoyed working with young players, helping them develop. He did this with Detroit and Cleveland. Interesting fact, of course, Detroit and Cleveland famously traded managers in mid-season, Jimmy Dykes for Joe Gordon. What is less known is that they also traded coaches a week later. Luke Appling went from Detroit to Cleveland to rejoin his longtime manager Dykes, and JoJo White went the other direction to rejoin Joe Gordon. But in Kansas City, when Charlie O'Finley was the owner of Kansas City, he decided, Finley, of course, having grown up in Chicago in the 20s and 30s, decided to recreate a bit of his childhood by hiring not one but two Chicago Hall of Famers as coaches, Appling and Gabby Hartnett. But in 1967, Appling is neither in the dugout nor on the coaching lines. He is a special assignment scout with the Athletics. A reporter asked Appling what that meant, and Appling, with a wink and a nod, said, "Shh, can't tell you, it's a secret." He was, however, you know, sort of responsible for going around and helping players in the athletic system and things like that. Why are we talking about the Athletics? They were in 10th place, RJ. Why are you bringing them into the picture? Well, funny story. They were actually expected to contend starting in 1967. They were still in Kansas City, but they were starting to develop some young players and had a good farm system going up. People like Sal Bando, Reggie Jackson, Joe Rudy weren't quite to the major league level yet, but people were anticipating that certainly they they were getting there and would probably be contending in a couple of years. In 67, they actually were playing 500 ball for the first couple of seasons before things started to fall apart. Partly having to do with, I mean, some of that success, of course, is credited to Finley, but some of that falling apart can also be laid at Finley's feet. He had a tendency for interfering with players. He would go up to players directly and say, you know, why are you hitting 350 with singles? You should be hitting home runs, and they would try to hit home runs and flounder and go back to the minors. And Finley would be like, wow, why didn't that work? He would also do things like Alan, I wrote there, Alan Lewis, first designated runner. That may not actually be true. I don't know why I wrote that, but certainly anticipating the Herbert Washington experience a few years later. But Finley thought he could win games with speed and pitching, which he probably could have, but lose a few more. But in any case, a lot of the story I can owe to John Peterson's book on the Kansas City Athletics, which tells several of the stories we're going to get into. August 20th, the manager is Alvin Dark, who's not a Luke Appling style manager, let's say, but definitely a more tougher manager, tougher on the players, but and so forth. Finley and Dark will clash over an incident involving Lou Kraus, an airplane, and a ridiculous amount of alcohol. Kraus earlier had been nearly arrested for firing a .38 out of his hotel room window after a particularly tough loss. Finley kind of smoothed that over with the police and the reporters, but basically told Lou Kraus that he was down to his last chance. Well, after a particularly nasty loss on the airplane, Lou got, by his own admission in Peterson's book, Lou got kind of drunk and rowdy and so forth. Now, here we are many years later. I find it hard to believe some of the stories that people were saying, oh, well, these were just, you know, young men blowing off steam, having a good time. I somehow suspect that there were lots of things that we're not hearing about, and that in this era we would probably be hearing a more complete story than we did from the pre-Ball Four days. But 1967, basically, again, what happens is the aftermath is basically Finley bans alcohol on team flights and then issues a public statement saying that his team wasn't being disciplined and needed to behave better in public, basically. Dark was upset about this, but Appling had fired him as a result because he basically said, well, you've lost control of the team. Dark and Finley meet in the hotel room on their next stop, and basically they brush things, they smooth things over. Finley rehires Dark, and then the next shoe drops. The A's players have issued a statement critical of Finley, saying, because apparently it's okay for Finley to publicly blast his players, but it's not okay for the players to publicly blast Finley. But the A's players have issued a statement saying, Finley doesn't know how to run a team, and he's treating us like kids, which they didn't take kindly to, and so forth. So Dark knew about the statement was coming, but he hadn't seen it. But when Finley found out that Dark had known about it and that it was coming, he fired Dark again. So who is he going to put in as manager? Well, he has coaches that have been with the team, but Finley goes in a different direction. He decides to bring in secret agent scout Luke Appling as the manager. Appling hasn't been with the team at all, but he says, okay, I don't know what's going on. I'm just gonna go in and find out. It's like we're just gonna start from scratch here. But the A's players he's basically lost the A's players before he even has a chance to join the team. They all like him, they all think he's a nice guy, but they're upset about Dark, and they're like, this cracks me up because 1974, the first pennant race I really remember following in detail, my vision of Alvin Dark as a manager is shaped by Sal Bando saying that Dark couldn't manage a bleeping meat market. And that's 7 years later. Of course, Bando wasn't a figure. But that's, you know, so I find it intriguing that the players are backing Dark 7 years earlier. That there's some cognitive dissonance for me here. Ken Harrelson, of course, was famously quoted as saying that Finley was a menace to baseball. He's not in a position to, but he's basically released unconditionally. Appling really never would have had a chance to manage in 1968 anyway, but there's no way he's going to get the control of the team back after this. So how's the rest of the season playing out? Well, here we are back at I'm going to do a week-by-week summary here. So we start off with the Twins, Red Sox, White Sox, and Tigers. We saw earlier that the White Sox were tied with the Twins at the time of the Dark firing. But the next week, the White Sox play three doubleheaders, two due to rainouts, and go 5-5. So they slide back a little bit, but nobody else really emerges, like I said, to take charge. This was the period where Eddie Stanky lights that fire that really fizzled out. It didn't really get anybody agitated other than people just saying, yeah, Eddie, what's he gonna say? I included this, I'm gonna skip this on managerial tendencies because really it's not relevant. Dark was a little more aggressive in managerial decisions. Appling was a little more let people play. He did, you know, his changes, pinch hitters and relief pitchers were about league average. The following week, the White Sox go 4-3. They managed to win three out of four at Boston. Ken Berry is featured there because he had a game-winning home run, or not a game-winning home run, but a walk-off pinch hit. Apparently still seething over the cancellation of F Troop earlier in the year. So he took it out on the Boston pitchers. The following week, the White Sox go 5-3. There are two notable games here. The Sabre Games Project has a great story about the win over California, so I'd point people to that. Creates four-way tie for first place. Actually, it wasn't a four-way tie, but everybody was in within a game of each other. The also notable is that they went 2-for-2 with Detroit, but Joe Horlan throws a no-hitter during his start. Notable in that I can't think of too many times that a pitcher has thrown a no-hitter in September for a contending team against another contending team. Addy Joss in 1908, his perfect game against the White Sox, is kind of the only one that came to mind. There are probably others. I didn't have time to research that. I think that would be an interesting topic in and of itself. The following week, we have two walk-off wins, one sparked by Ron Hansen, the Hansen game wasn't a walk-off, but he hit two home runs in that game in Comiskey Park, go figure, giving him eight for the season. And Pete Ward had the walk-off against Minnesota. Gary Peters also had a sterling win against Minnesota as well. September 18th through the 24th, White Sox actually win two out of three, or four out of two, or four out of six, actually, against California and Cleveland. So now they're still within the game, but again, nobody else is really cutting loose from the pack here. Everybody's kind of trading punches at this point. So, morning of September 27th. Why is September 27th? Funny story. Minnesota is up with Chicago a game back. Everybody has about three or four games left, five or six games left to play. Monday, September 25th is a travel day. They're going from Cleveland to Kansas City for a two-game set, but they don't get to play on Tuesday the 26th because it rains, forcing a doubleheader on the 27th. At this point, oddly enough, the White Sox and Athletics are even for the season. They're 8-8. The A's had taken a couple of series, two out of three, earlier in the season, and had pretty much, again, traded punches since then. So we come to September 27th. The Sabre Games Project account by Thomas Nosby is really good. One of the things I was looking for, is there anything that Luke Appling did notable during these games? He didn't, apparently, like we said, was not a hands-on manager. There's one story in the Peterson book about There was a critical decision that had to be made in one of the games Appling was managing, and nobody could find him. He had gone back into the clubhouse for a sandwich, unfortunately. So. But he didn't really have to do much managing in this game. Chuck Dodson went had a shutout into the ninth inning. Gary Peters got knocked out of the game in the sixth. Dodson said, "I wanted to get a shutout because he hated Eddie Stanky. Stanky had made some rude comments to him earlier in the season. Dodson was upset about that, so he really wanted to stick it to Stanky. He almost did. He wanted to get the shutout, but got some ninth inning jitters. Appling put in Lou Krause, who was singularly ineffective, did not retire a batter. Paul Lindblad finally comes in and puts out the fire, 5-2. Appling did make those two pitching changes, one which didn't work, but one which did. No other real noticeable activity in that game. Jim Hunter, Catfish Hunter, comes up next with a complete game shutout. And not only that, but he takes out Les Josephson in a home plate collision. You wouldn't see pitchers doing this very often, I wouldn't think. But where that's noticeable is that both Hunter and Horland were pitching a shutout into the sixth inning. J.C. Martin takes over for Les Josephson behind the plate. The sixth inning really goes badly. Five singles, a walk, an error, and a passed ball. Would things have been different if Josephson had continued catching Horland since they were kind of on a hot streak? Hard to say, obviously, but what can you do? Kansas City 4, Chicago nothing. So those two losses to the Athletics pretty much effectively knock Chicago out of the race. On the next morning, the best they can do is a tie with the White Sox, or with either the Twins, the Tigers, or the Red Sox. And but they have three games against Washington, where Minnesota and Boston have to play each other. Detroit has two doubleheaders scheduled against California, again making up rainouts. So you'd think the White Sox might have a shot at forcing a tie, but that doesn't happen. The White Sox lose all three games against Washington, whereas, as everybody knows, the Red Sox sweep both of their games against the Twins. The Tigers split their four games with California, putting the impossible dream Red Sox up in first place. What it comes down to, basically, is the White Sox, they gave up fewer runs than anybody, as noted there, by almost 100. Fewer than any other team, but boy, did their bats were terrible. Their hitting, their runs scored were wrong, but New York and ninth place New York and 10th place Kansas City were doing at the time. So what does that mean? Well, one thing that I think you can maybe say that Kansas City knocked Chicago out of the race. They were the only team that posted a winning, or they, the White Sox were the only team that the Athletics posted a winning record against during that season. They were pretty much abysmal against anybody else. If you could say that the White Sox could have played Athletics as tough as Boston did, 6-12, or Detroit 6-12, or even Minnesota 8-10, that might have made a difference for the White Sox in 67. But frankly, they were kind of at the end of their string. They were going to go back to the 1968 team would not post a winning record. Eddie Stanky would not be much longer for the team as well. Luke Appling, secret agent, goes back undercover. He's fired as a manager after the season, but he returns to be a special assignment scout for the Athletics, who are now in Oakland. He returns to coaching, notably with the White Sox for 2 years, with Atlanta for 14, two of those in the dugout, and the rest of those as a batting coach, which he apparently just totally loved. Here he is seen with the Oakland Athletics manager, Bob Kennedy, and some guy who used to play for the Yankees. So. Thanks, of course, to Baseball Reference, Saber Games Project, RetroSheet, my partner in crime, Richard Smiley, who helped with this, and the newspapers of the day. I think we can at least say, okay, Luke Appling 2, White Sox 0. And I should say, in passing, first of all, thank you all for waking up early to be here. And if you get a chance to check out Richard's presentation, also dipping into the irony about Luke Appling theme, Luke Appling slugger, about his home run hitting prowess. So, any questions?
Being a Yankee fan, I noticed the Yankees were next to last. How did the Yankees do against the White Sox in that season?
I don't remember. I think they had a losing record, but I couldn't tell. I couldn't tell you for sure.
As a kid growing up in Philadelphia that year, I seem to remember pretty significant. The Sox did all that, did that well. I remember when Horland pitched that no-hitter, there was a lot of stuff going on in Chicago. I think something called the riots were going on that summer in Chicago that didn't make things any easier for anybody.
That's true. I didn't think about adding that to this. But Roger, you mentioned that you were at the games in Kansas City. Any anecdotes about that?
First of all, the crowd was not that big because it was actually was the last games at Municipal for the A's because the city sort of soured on Finley at that time because the rumors were still going on, even though in June of that year we passed the dual stadium bond issue. And I was little at the time, I was only about eight, so I did not see I saw the Dobson game, but I did not stay for the Hunter game.
Okay.
And, Krause, there was always talk because Monty Moore, who was the A's play-by-play announcer, was the one who squealed on Finley, but I think Peterson might have mentioned, or somebody did once, that it might have been Finley's nephew who was on that plane that caused Finley to find out.
We were talking about Finley's nephew the other night.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. I can take one more question, I'm told.
Great presentation, RJ.
Thank you.
Looking at the teams at the top of the standings, Mickey Lolich, the last week of July, served in the National Guard as the Detroit riot was going on. Did you have a look at his statistics in the last 2 months of the season? At what impact that had on the Tigers' performance?
I did not. I was focused more on the Appling and the White Sox parts of the story, but that would be an interesting thing to look at. I think we're most familiar with Red Sox and Yastrzemski having a fantastic September, but that would be an interesting to see how much of a difference that made. I would agree. Thank you, everybody.